What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
It is the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson with Gareth Roberts, Ian Ryan and Amelia Bonner to talk about the Community Shield. John Gibbons will be joining us because he spoke to Alan Wares of Albion Raw yesterday to talk about Brighton and Hove Albion getting people into the football ground and what that was like logistically and in terms of how it felt. And then we will have a chat about Liverpool's policy decisions thus far around transfers. That is all to come on the Anfield Wrap this week. We do a lot of shows about a lot of different things, and you can subscribe to them, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe. But first and foremost, let's start off and talk about the Community Shield. And Gareth, ultimately, I've watched both actual pre-season friendlies, glorified friendlies, and games after Liverpool have won the league and got it confirmed and in the bag. And I'm now very firmly of the view that not winning is rubbish. It's difficult to get away from. Having won an awful lot, played 27, won 26, I'm struggling just a little bit with not winning. And that's in terms of literally the end result. But also, there's actually been a fair bit of time in games that we've seen since football came back after coronavirus hit, where Liverpool just haven't been ahead, have been behind, and have been toiling a little bit. And I think this is another one that follows that pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would give Arsenal some credit as well. I mean, I think, you know, traditionally or recently, you know, we've always battered them, really. I know we lost in the league to them, you know, when football came back and all the rest of it. But what I mean is we've got them down as being flaky. And I thought they were less flaky.
Anything but flaky.
Do you know what I mean? They were very much like a different side. And, you know, Arteta's done some work there, obviously, and deserves some credit for that. But from Liverpool's point of view, yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a worry, isn't there? I think in that, you know, back ends of winning the league, add this onto that. But, you know, I don't know. I'm still sort of... It's not the first 11, is it? We missed Trent, we missed Henderson. It was a bit of a sort of a nothing performance. But equally, you know, Arsenal score a great goal and then sit on the great goal for the majority of the game, create one or two other chances. But yeah, it is crap not winning. I think we've got used to winning. We've become a little bit spoiled by it all. I'm not the biggest fan of the Charity Shield. I've always been one that can go either way with it. I'm not sort of tearing out my hair that no. We haven't won it. Equally, if we had won it, I would have just been like, oh, well, that's we've won again. Would have been fairly blasé about it. So I don't think there's an awful lot to read into it. I wrote something for our Facebook page saying, you know, really, we shouldn't be making mass judgments about this. But, you know, the world's not like that, is it? That's not the way it all works with the media around football and everything else. People do make mass judgments, and so straight away it's like, oh well, you know, is the crown slipping already? Is this the old Liverpool? Can they go again? All of those things. I mean, for me, I just want to batter Leeds. That's what I've always been about. I want to absolutely batter
and
Leeds,
specifically just Leeds, and I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what I mean? So like, we start the season with a 4-0 or something against Leeds. This game is completely forgotten about.
It's one where the shape of the game, Ian, it gets completely defined by the opening goal, in that if Liverpool had got to the hour mark at 0-0, played the play in the way they played, we'd all say, well, that's a pretty solid, reliable sort of run towards, you know, just beyond half time. Now you change it around and you go from there. But the fact that they get the goal and the nature of the goal, you felt like Liverpool were therefore failing to break down a stubborn defence, failing to deal with a game plan that you're able to say had worked because Arsenal were so strong down the left. And that shifted things a little bit. And I think Liverpool... I'm very in favour of playing when 1-0 down, or for that matter 1-0 up, like it's 0-0. I haven't got a problem with that, but every now and again I'd quite like that not to happen, and this was one of them where Liverpool just looked a little bit almost like they'd chosen to blunt themselves, not just the idea that they were also blunt.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think I had a couple of reservations when I saw the team, to be honest, and I think It wasn't a secret that Arsenal would have attacked down the left. They've done it in other games. And obviously with Nico Williams playing, there was an obvious place to target. Young kid, not many appearances, etc., etc. But I think in terms of Liverpool as an attacking threat for a minute, I was concerned with the midfield because I thought, well, if you haven't got Trent, And we know Trent gives us so much. He's a brilliant footballer, and he's been superb for a long, long time now. And without him, you're taking away such an attacking threat. And obviously, a lot of it went down the left-hand side, and Robbo created numerous opportunities and can probably be asking himself why he hasn't got an assist from that game, given the amount of balls he put in, quality balls. But I think without Trent, you're then thinking, well, you haven't got Henderson either. And I think the tempo for me was, I felt it might be a problem. And I think you've seen it a number of times where maybe the likes of Milner and Wijnaldum have played together. You've not quite had that tempo. And it's not a criticism of Milner, to be honest, because I think, or Wijnaldum, because I think, you know, separately or with other players, they're perfectly fine. And I think Milner actually played really well, I thought. But you did feel like Arsenal, if they were going to get joy from anywhere, they would get joy from that. From that left-hand side, their left-hand side, our right-hand side. And I say it's not a great goal to concede from a Liverpool point of view. And I've seen all the chat about Williams and stuff. Listen, he's a young kid and he gets done by a player who is world-class, certainly at finishing. And we've seen it throughout his time in the Premier League. Aubameyang's a superb player. Klopp knows all about him. It just happens sometimes. But I don't think Liverpool are great in terms of helping Williams out. I think you can say, well, because it wasn't a surprise, more should have been happening from our forward players, midfielders, getting across and supporting them. And Robbo said before, listen, Arsenal deserve credit, and they do deserve credit because they work it really well. And there's a nice little trio there of Tierney, Maitland-Niles and Aubameyang, and they're overlapping and they're overloading, and they're making it really difficult for Liverpool. And it's even more difficult, you're playing a young kid there. And we've seen it with Trent. Now, Trent's had periods of his career where he's very, very early on in it, and he'll get exposed because I think for young players, it just is really hard in terms of if you're a young player and you're a defender. I think it's different when you're an attacking player because you're not necessarily having to get into tight of people, you're looking for space, but youngsters have to get close. They have to engage in physical battles, and that's where it becomes tricky because you're not quite fully grown and stuff like that. But Arsenal work it really well, Neil. But I think for me, disappointingly, even after the goal, it took us a while to get any kind of momentum. I think we were quite slow and pedestrian in our passing, certainly for the first hour. I think that was the biggest kind of slant against the team on Saturday afternoon, to be honest. Just how long it took us to get going and how long it took us to be purposeful with our passing.
I think that the speed of Liverpool's play, Amelia, I think is something that was frustrating. It was frustrating for the first hour, at least. Everything seemed to take a little bit longer than you'd like. Everything took another touch. It changed when Keita and Minamino came on. We can go into the sort of the specifics of that in a minute or two. But there is a thing, isn't there, at times where Liverpool, I worry, do just let themselves be slowed down a little bit. When maybe if they took a few more risks, went forward, went to be just a little bit more dynamic with it, they could up the tempo to the point that the opposition can't cope. And that's what they were doing so well between August and February of last season.
Yeah, and as you say, I thought Minamino was brilliant when he came on. Obviously, there's the goal and the penalty, but he is brilliant generally when he comes on. And I think that for the last kind of 10, 15 minutes of it, I did keep saying, I think we're fine here, I can see us just getting another one, because we looked, as you say, there's the speed of the play, but it looked like it was just Liverpool doing what Liverpool do. It looked like it was just going to happen, and there wasn't that need for like the extra touch. There wasn't that kind of, not disjointedness, but the kind of, it didn't look like it was quite there for the first hour. And for the last bit of the game, I just thought, easy this, it'll just be 2-1. This is going to be really, you know, we're just going to walk through this, it'll be fine. And then that didn't end up being the case. But I thought for the latter little chunk of the game, we did actually look brilliant, and we looked like the Liverpool we've been used to seeing for a Premier League winning season. It's just a shame that it ends the way it does. I don't know, as you say, you can not care about it, and you can say to yourself, oh well, we don't really need to, you know, it's the Charity Shield, we don't really need to win it. But it's like going for a job that you don't really want. When you don't get it, you're still like, would have been nice to have got it and turned it down though. Do you know, it would be nice to kind of have won it and go, oh well, we weren't even that bothered about it anyway, it's just something to add to all the silverware. But it doesn't make it any less disappointing.
It's not disappointing, Amelia. It remains disappointing, Amelia, because the way the game plays out. I think also the other aspect of it that just sort of became personally disappointing was the way in which the manager introduces Brewster so late in the game. He doesn't get a meaningful kick of the ball prior to the penalty. And then the way in which he strikes the penalty, you know, we are really talking about very, very fine margins. And yeah, then it therefore sort of, you'd almost rather have had any of the other takers be the one who missed.
You do,
and that's
really
where it does hurt.
you feel for him, because I think you can, it was a daft decision. It's not fair to bring him on that late just to take a penalty. And there's a part of you that can kind of see why, given that he has scored a few during the friendlies and is obviously on a bit of a roll, and kind of you'd think like if he's kind of buoyed by that, and it's like, although it is just the Community Shield, it's something where you'd go, oh, and he scored in X, he'd scored a penalty in this and it was brilliant. And you kind of think maybe there's this narrative or this idea of it being kind of his, you know, his moment is returned to the team, and it's this big, you know, it finishes it off after some nice goals and some nice play in the friendlies, but it doesn't turn out that way. And I don't think it's entirely fair. And I think with Rhian Brewster coming onto the pitch, knowing everyone would like it to turn out that way, there's a lot more pressure there. And you do really feel for him. You can see his face after he misses it, and kind of after Arsenal score the last one. It just, you know, he does look gutted with himself. Even though it's not something that really matters, he's still going to know it's him that's kind of let it down at the end.
It just sort of did feel like an unnecessary hammer blow, Gareth. It's one thing to lose on penalties, but the nature of that one, not least because you do get to see the drama play out on his face as much as anything else. You know, it's not one of them where he's able to sort of stay and passive. You get to see Curtis Jones give him a kiss, and it's all very nice that, and it shows that obviously the way in which Curtis thinks and thinks about the game, and that's, you know, a credit to him. But it just suddenly felt like a really weird bit of drama that we'd added into proceedings for reasons I don't entirely understand. And it's nearly a brilliant penalty.
Yeah, it is nearly a brilliant penalty, and that was sort of what came to my mind. I mean, I've seen a lot of people sort of, you know, criticising the manager for bringing him on when he did and saying, why wasn't it earlier and stuff like that? But, you know, a couple of inches down, and we're saying, well, what a brilliant thing he brought him on, and he got to score that brilliant penalty. That'll boost his confidence, etc., yeah, etc. It's fine margins, isn't it? And it's top-level sport, and it's one of them. I mean, you know, what doesn't break you makes you stronger and all that kind of stuff. Like Adrian as well. Was tweeting them about it as well, and you know, that was another example of, like, you know, putting the arm around the kid and all that kind of stuff. I think he'd be absolutely fine. I think in that moment, obviously, he was hurt and he wished he'd took his opportunity, and, you know, you can see how desperate he is to take his chance this time around, because I didn't feel he did last time. You know, when Sturridge left, you know, it was bigged up that he would get an opportunity. He got a couple of opportunities. He didn't really take them. And then I think that was one of the reasons he was shipped out on loan. This time, it looks like he'll get another one. You know, he can argue, and we can argue, that it was harsh to put him on so late. But, you know, I just think it'd be fine. I just think, you know, it's another one of those things, like in the moment right now, you know, only a couple of days after the match, it feels like a thing, you know, a couple of weeks or months down the road, we're not going to still be going on about, oh, remember when Klopp brought him on that late and you know, he hit the bar with a penalty. It's just one of them. It's one of them things in football. I think the lads will be absolutely fine. I'd take more and talk more about the goals he scored the other day. I still think the one, you know, where he's got to hit it and he's got to put it in the certain place and he's got a defender coming in behind him and all that, and he hits it and he puts it right in the spot. Such an instinctive finish. That's the bit of recent Brewster that I'm excited about.
And Swansea as well. Do you know what I mean? If you're looking at things that show the mark of a player and what he could be for Liverpool, you can take a lot more from the way he plays in the friendlies and the goals, but also what he's doing at Swansea before he comes back is kind of like, that's, you take a lot more from that, and you can see a lot more of the player that he is than you can from one missed penalty that is, as you say, inches.
Going back, Gareth, to the way in which the first half plays out, is that one of the things, and Liverpool have got to be careful, I think, with this in a general sense. We know the quality Liverpool have got from wide areas from the fullbacks. But for me, that's a bit of a double-edged sword, as so many things are. Sometimes your strengths can become a little bit of your weaknesses. Liverpool, therefore, know that if they work the ball into wide areas, and obviously there was no Alexander-Arnold, but from the left as well with Robertson, they can expect to get quality in. But you end up in a situation where the opposition expect to have to defend quality as well. And I, you know, there's times where it just sort of suits centre-halves if they're just dealing with cross after cross. They can settle into a rhythm of dealing with cross, even if they're really good balls, and some of them from Robertson were really, really good balls. I feel at times like the cross has almost got to be the garnish on the way Liverpool attack. It when it becomes the primary weapon, things aren't quite right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's just very percentages, and it's just throwing a decent cross into the box, and it's sort of what we've grown up with a little bit in you know, like beat the man, get to the byline and put a cross in and sort of hope for the best a little bit. And you know, centre-halves are always massive. Centre-halves always love always love heading things. And so, you know, sometimes you've got to be a bit cuter and a bit more clever. And that was what was missing, I think. I think there was a point there, maybe 70-odd minutes, where it was coming up on the screen that Robertson had threw in sort of like 11 crosses. And yeah, you're like, wow. But equally then you're like, you know, and I wondered the same, really. Was it a bit of... They were almost happy with that. They were almost happy to let a channel down that side, him put a cross in, and them take the chances on defending it, because more often than not, obviously, it worked for them. And, you know, the goal doesn't come from a Robertson cross. So, you know, in terms of that, you know, Arsenal will say job done. And they probably said, listen, they haven't got Trent there. And Trent's huge for them. Trent's a big playmaker for them. Trent, as we've discussed so many times, could easily... playing midfield, you know, he's got figures that are up there with De Bruyne from a right back position. So of course you're going to miss that, and we did miss that, and we had a teenage kid in his place who struggled a bit at the weekend. Again, though, that's going to happen in terms of his development. You know, I've seen a lot of criticism of Nico Williams, and I just thought, well, I can understand it in the moment again. But, you know, equally, look where he is and look where he's come from and look what he can be. You know, he's another one. I think he'll be absolutely fine. And we've just got to cop for the fact, as we did with Trent when he first come on the scene, that he'll make mistakes, that he'll do things wrong at times. It's learning from them, though, and it's getting better from that. And I think he will do. But, yeah, you wanted more from Liverpool's midfield, didn't you? You wanted more from elsewhere, I think, in terms of creativity, like Ian was saying before. And that's what was lacking. You know, you can point to one or two chances there and say, well, you know, maybe we should do better. Milner should score and things like that. But, you know, there wasn't enough, and there wasn't enough clear cut. And you don't want that to become a thing as we move into the new season.
I want to talk about in a fair bit of detail, actually, the changes on the hour mark when he brings Keita and Minamino on, but how much it changes. We'll talk a little bit about Wijnaldum after the substitutions, what it does in the defensive line as well, Ian. But let's start with the lads who come on first and foremost. I think suddenly Liverpool, you know, Salah goes centre forward, Firmino in behind. You felt like Firmino was more involved. There was loads of the ball getting into Salah's feet, and there was loads of Minamino and Keita playing those balls into people's feet, giving goes around the edge of the area. And I think that Arsenal genuinely struggle to cope with it. They cannot cope with that sort of football. And it's, again, it's still a little bit percentage, but it just felt like the percentages went up massively in Liverpool's favour.
Yeah, I think all of a sudden you see the threats from multiple areas, whereas, you know, first half it very much is Robertson putting crosses in. And I think Arsenal got three centre-halves there playing on Saturday, and I think they were fairly comfortable with balls coming into the box. You know, they're not going to get beaten in the air, stuff like that. Maybe great movement might beat them, but I think they look comfortable with balls coming into the box, albeit good ones. But all of a sudden, and this is why I thought Keita should have started, to be honest, because all of a sudden you've got a player who's willing to take the ball and just drive a little bit, and all of a sudden he's committing men, and he's got that ability where he can just take one or two fellas out in a heartbeat, and it just opens the game up so much. And as I alluded to before, it's not a criticism of Milner or Gini, but that's not necessarily their game. You've already got Fabinho there sitting, and it just feels ultra conservative from the middle of the park if you're not going to have someone like a Keita in there, or if you haven't got Henderson, who we know sets the tempo really well. And by setting the tempo, he gets Liverpool on the front foot really quickly. And we dallied and we dithered a little bit against Arsenal, to the point where Arsenal are really good, but Arsenal do make mistakes. They give the ball away a number of times, but Liverpool just haven't got that almost pass where it forces it a little bit, and it punishes you for your mistakes. That wasn't happening. We were letting Arsenal off the hook a little bit. They grow in confidence, etc. And I think all of a sudden Keita comes on and he's willing to commit players. And Minamino as well, I thought. You see signs of Minamino against Stuttgart where not necessarily the penny's dropping, because he's always wanted to do well, but I think you're starting to see some of the work that's been going on behind the scenes come to fruition a little bit. And there's that little period of the play against Stuttgart where there's a couple of lads just bouncing off him a little bit, and he's able to win the physical battle. You weren't seeing that. If you take it back to his first appearance against Wolves, you're absolutely not seeing him win any physical battles, because he looks very lightweight, albeit against an ultra-strong team in Wolverhampton Wanderers. But I thought you're starting to see signs now where, again, confidence, Minamino's growing in confidence, but physically he looks a little bit better. He looks a bit more equipped. You see after the goal, I think the goal will do him a world of good, by the way, but he immediately wants the ball again. He scores the goal, wants the ball, let's go again. So I think those two lads made a huge contribution. And I think, you know, if you're the manager now, you've got to start thinking about what Leeds looks like. And I think if you're going to be without Henderson, I know he's coming back in terms of training, I think you've got to start looking at what that midfield looks like. Because if you're an opposition manager, one thing you say in the season is, we've got to stop the supply from the fullback areas. And it's easier said than done, but there will be games where Liverpool get shut out on the flanks, and therefore that midfield area has got to be a little bit more creative, I think, at times. And on Saturday, it just lacked, certainly for the first hour, it lacked that creativity.
It felt a little bit immediately like they were almost, it was three people doing two people's jobs. And I know that sounds really basic in one sense, but that's the change the manager makes. There's three of them in there being responsible, but simultaneously Liverpool are getting opened up a little bit, meant to be in there to stimulate creativity, but Liverpool aren't doing enough of it. And it's interesting that he doesn't just, the sub that he makes, or the two subs he makes on the hour mark, it changes quite profoundly all three areas of the pitch. Fabinho is now at centre-half, Gomez is at right-back. We've only got two midfielders, centre midfielders on the pitch, Wijnaldum and Keita, and one of them is obviously a new introduction there. And then the other thing that it changes as well is that front line goes from being the three with Firmino through the middle, Salah right and Mane left. So suddenly Mane's on the right, Salah's through the middle, Firmino's in behind, and Minamino's coming from the left. And the point about this is that's in terms of a game of football, that's a really radical substitution. We've just changed the positions there of, I think, about six players have now got profoundly different roles before you'd even get to the substitutes. And I think that firstly is obviously interesting, but secondly, it just suddenly felt like Liverpool were operating in the space better. You didn't have three midfielders getting in each other's way. You had two with really clear jobs.
Yeah, it's a different team, essentially, even though you've only changed two lads that are on the pitch. It is a completely different team with the nature of the set and how you move people around. But I think what you said there is right, that before that, it is responsible, sensible and responsible, which there's nothing wrong with. And as you say, if it had been a kind of, if things had gone slightly differently, and if we hadn't been 1-0 down, you wouldn't have seen as much of a problem with that. But it does, it completely changes it, opens it up. And as Ian said, it just felt more threatening. There was a sudden kind of like, it was clear that Arsenal wouldn't have been able to deal with that for that much longer. It was completely different. And I think you're right about Minamino, that you did really notice a difference when he came on the pitch, and that he does seem more threatening. There's more kind of, it's the confidence, and it's not just the confidence in him, it's he's confident as a Liverpool player and kind of in those battles. And he just looks like he fits in the squad a bit better now, with there being quite a big change when he comes on and people moving about and stuff. It just made a lot more sense, and it looked like the kind of football that we're used to watching, and the kind of football that I hope we'll get to watch more of. I know that without Henderson, everything is a bit different, and you do really, really miss him, and you notice it at several points. But yeah, it's better. It's much better.
We'll come back on to Henderson. I want to talk to you all three of you about that. But the other thing about the shape was, we rightly praise the two subs who come on, but I think, for instance, Gareth, I think that you get much more out of Firmino after the change. I think you get a little more out of Salah after the change. I think that Gomez does perfectly well at right back, and Fabinho's fine at centre-half. I'm intrigued by Wijnaldum. At the minute, Wijnaldum feels weirdly a complicated figure for Liverpool, and he really shouldn't. He's still literally the same footballer that he was 8-9 months ago. But one of the things I think that changes is he's suddenly got more of the pitch he's responsible for. And it was quite clear what Keita's responsibility was, and it was quite clear what Wijnaldum's responsibility was. And I actually think that both play really, really well after the subs. And there's suddenly room for them to play. Wijnaldum's taking the ball off people, turning away from them, moving forward with it, and then feeding what we can just call quickly, in inverted commas, the better attackers, and letting them get on from there. And I think at times when you play three centre midfielders, it is sort of easy for one to get a bit lost in terms of contribution. And I thought that Wijnaldum looked a different player after the subs.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's just about finding, you know, a balance, isn't it? And we've seen that, you know, we see that in football as well. You know, there's partnerships, there's threesomes in terms of players that just seem to work together, seem to, you know, the balance is better. And I think you add that, you know what you're getting from Naby. You know that he's going to carry the ball. You know that he's going to take people on. You know that he's going to pass forward, try and have a shot. You know, he's not going to sit. He's not going to play it safe. He's not that type of player. And I think Genie, you know, knowing that, then, as you say, his role is more defined. Whereas, because he's a bit of a mad player in that, you know, he can do so many things quite well. So, you know, he's almost like sort of jack of all trades, master of none, one of those type of things. Because, you know, it almost becomes forgotten that he was, you know, he's a 10 for Newcastle. You know, he's played there for Holland as well. And then, he's been more of a sort of, you know, just a fella who moves the ball along, who holds the shape, who's there to help block off passing lanes and things like that. But yeah, it did work much better. And I think, as Ian says, you know, we've got to be looking at that midfield balance for Leeds and for going forwards if Henderson's not going to be available, because we know he is back in training. But, you know, he was missed on Saturday. I don't think we're getting that performance in the first half if he's in the side, just in terms of not only what he does with the ball, but in terms of being a leader. You know, I think we can talk about him really plainly now as being a good leader. You know, once upon a time, there was question marks around his captaincy, but they are no more, not only because of what Liverpool have won, but also what you see from him on the pitch. You know, he never stops. He's shouting. He's in the referee's face, all of those things. And, you know, you get a bit of that from Milner, obviously. But I think Henderson's on another level now in terms of the leader. And there's nothing wrong with missing your captain. That's why the captain, he's really grown into the role. But, yeah, I wouldn't want to see that midfield again against Leeds in a home game. I don't think we will see that midfield again. And yet, Naby's the one for me. I think, you know, after lockdown and all that, when football resumed, even during the pre-season friendlies, again, at the weekend, you know, you're seeing the player that we expected to see now from Naby Keita. I just hope he can stay fit and continue to produce that, because I think he's the one we've got in the ranks that when sides are shutting up shop, when they are blocking, you know, the roots from the fullbacks, he's the one who can help make a difference, and hopefully Minamino as well. You know, Van Dijk obviously talked about Minamino coming out of his shell. He's another one. You know, those two players are the lads in midfield who can provide some creativity, set up some goals, and see us scoring in a different way. I think you're right as well about Mo there, in that, you know, I was sort of bemoaning him, saying, well, he's done nothing here. You know, he's not being in it. And then, you know, that shape change gave Arsenal something to think about, and all of a sudden he's picking up a little bit of space. All of a sudden he's getting an opportunity to run after the fence, and you know, it's one of his runs that proves crucial to Minamino scoring the goal.
I think there's been a fear. Naby's a player where it's always felt like it's his first season with us, even though it absolutely isn't anymore, and I feel like there's always been a fear that he's not going to quite turn out to be the player that we all wanted him to be, or that we hoped that he'd be. And I always think of us talking about him on a wild card in a few years' time, being like, he was a player that you were really excited for that didn't turn out to be it, and Naby felt like he was going to be that, or certainly the player that Rob Gutman hoped he would be. But I don't know, as you say, it does feel, certainly yesterday did, or Saturday did, and in kind of like the last few times we've seen him, it does feel like finally this is it. And it, as long as he stays fit, that's it.
There's something for me on the Henderson thing, and I agree with the idea that, you know, I would certainly like to see of Liverpool's four league games before the next international break. There's one coming now. Obviously, I would like to see Keita start all four. But there's something for me, Gareth, which you mentioned there. To me, it's really strange the extent to which Liverpool miss Henderson these days. And the reason why isn't, you know, this isn't an attack on Henderson. He's a footballer I've long admired and thought he's very, very important to Liverpool. But there was a period of time, you know, you get to about August 2019 before we play Southampton away, and everyone's a bit like, well, where's Henderson going to play? What's the role now for Jordan Henderson in this Liverpool side? That's how much, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but that's how much he wasn't missed. And even, you know, last sort of September, October, Fabinho felt like Liverpool's most important midfielder. He's excellent against Manchester City. When they come to Anfield, he gets the goal. And if we all remember when Fabinho got the injury, everyone went into absolute meltdown and thought, oh no, what are we going to do now? There is a thing though where I think this Liverpool side really, really, really misses Jordan Henderson. And it's become, I think, more and more the case that Henderson, when he isn't on the pitch, it's now as noticeable when Henderson's not on the pitch as it is when Salah's not on the pitch, or as it is when Mane's not on the pitch. Now, we don't know whether or not it's as noticeable as when Van Dijk isn't on the pitch, but it is actually possibly even more noticeable than, for instance, when Alisson isn't on the pitch. And that is quite a shift, but it's also not that healthy in that Jordan Henderson, the way Liverpool play in midfield, he's not going to be starting every match. Liverpool have to have a plan to be functional when Jordan Henderson isn't there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you're almost, we're getting to the point now where you can almost forget about it at times. But, you know, that game on Saturday is played with no crowd. And, you know, that is still a bizarre circumstance, yep. Perhaps even more so when it's at Wembley Stadium. So, you know, it's this huge cavernous bowl with no one in it. And I just think, you know, it's easy or easier maybe for the mind to slip a little bit in terms of what you're meant to be doing and the intensity you're meant to be doing it at. And I just think Jordan Henderson is key to that for Liverpool in terms of both how what he does with the ball, but what he does with his mouth in terms of, you know, it feels like he's, you know, a manager on the pitch, someone who urges people on, someone who can spot things and you know, has that nous now as a footballer, you know, who's around the 30 years old mark. You know, it's the kind of thing that, like once upon a time, we used to say Didi Hamann brings to a team. No one went to sort of slow it down, went to speed it up, went to take the sting out of it, went to step it up, all of those things. You know, that nous doesn't come easy to all football players, I don't think. And it does now to Jordan Henderson. So he is key for that. And that's what we were missing. I think when you're having those dips, when you're sort of, you know, you're knocking the ball around, but you're not really creating problems. It needs someone to say, no, we need to speed this up, or we need to get it into feet earlier, or let's get it to Sadio, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Someone to have the balls to say something and not just let this pattern develop over and over. And I think that's what Jordan does.
But, Ian, as I say, he won't play every game. Firstly, he'll get the occasional injury. Secondly, you'll want to rest him to keep him fresh. And thirdly, he's out now with a knock, you know, but it is something to address. I mean, I said before, I'd play Naby Keita if Jordan was playing full stop. I think it is something that Liverpool are going to have to find a little way round. I think pretty soon it's a strange situation that they've ended up in, as I said before, because there was a period of time where it looked as though you were struggling to find a home for this player, and now he seems very integral to the way that Liverpool attack.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like you, Neil, I've always been a Jordan Henderson fan. And I think really, you know, even the people who maybe haven't been Jordan Henderson fans over the last 2 years or so will have found it hard to construct an argument that says Liverpool don't miss him when he's not there because of the performances, but also because of the mentality, which Robbo alludes to. And I think he's one who, I think, really appreciated the manager coming in and that mentality shift. I think he got it almost immediately. So last night on that programme, the 30-year wait thing on BBC Two, Henderson talks about Klopp instilling a mentality where they just refuse to give in and refuse to be beaten. And I think Henderson, more than most, absolutely gets that, where he will not lie down. He will keep going to the end. It is that mentality where he'll push himself, but he'll push others around him as well. It is your captain. At the end of the day, you're going to miss the captain of the football club. And I think one of the things that we have talked about, and I think we'll come on to it a little bit more, maybe talk about transfers, for instance, but, you know, Henderson is a player now who is picking up some injuries in the last kind of 2 or 3 years, and Naby Keita is another player that picks up injuries. Oxlade-Chamberlain picks up injuries. People will say that there's enough midfielders in Liverpool's squad, but similar to you, I'll always argue that you could have one more. Yeah. And it's for those reasons I've mentioned, because I think with the amount of games you're going to be playing, with the potential of having to shift Fabinho to centre-half, because Matip is another fella who misses too many games. And Joe Gomez has got a track record of injuries, albeit, you know, nothing too recent. So there's potential problems in that midfield. And you can see why Liverpool, despite people saying, well, they don't need an extra midfield, that Thiago's not what they need. But I think it is what they need, because he can dictate tempo similar to Jordan Henderson. There's a little bit of everything to his game. He can sit deep, but he can go further forward. He's a flexible footballer who offers quite a lot in both directions. But I just think because of the things I've mentioned, like you said before, Naby Keita, I'd start him in every game. So would I. But what are the chances of him being available for every game? Because he looks great when he's playing, but just getting him on the pitch is the reason why maybe one or two question marks still hang over Keita. It's that ability just to be robust and be able to go again and go again. And listen, Liverpool may have a plan for this. They may have a plan where they've brought in Morgan the physio again, and maybe they've got plans for some of these players where actually they're correcting some of the issues that have been going on over the last year or two. But there are others as well. And I think, you know, you look at Liverpool's bench on Saturday, it looks okay. There's a bit of quality in there, even though they're missing a number of players. But I think, you know, some of those players they are missing are regularly on the treatment table now. You people like Shaqiri and stuff who are still hanging around the squad but don't offer a great deal because they're always constantly missing. But I think in that midfield area, I can absolutely see why the manager's looking at another body in there, because with so many competitive games, with the closeness of those games, it's an area that we know he likes to shuffle a pack in the most. It kind of makes sense that he gets another lad in who can come in, do a little bit of everything, set tempo. And if he has got to take Jordan Henderson off the team, then someone like Thiago fills that void.
Amelia has got guests with her. Ian does brilliantly to out there, Robbo. Ian does brilliantly there, doesn't he, Robbo?
What am I doing here?
Me and Robbo were absolutely right on it. And Amelia was doing her best as she was going.
You've got two tiny little United fans here who are very excited to be involved.
Don't worry.
Go outside.
No. We can let them hang on in, Amelia. Don't worry at all. I'm going to ask you about Jordan Henderson and make you do this entire experience in the most brutal way possible. What's your feeling on how Liverpool sort of do deal with Henderson's absence? Because it appears to be both an absence of attitude, of influence, of technique, of someone being prepared to be very, very direct. What would you do with Henderson? How do you fix it when he's not there?
But I think what you said, to be honest, I hadn't even thought that, because I think it's been such a long road to getting us to all accepting that Henderson is very good.
That means thumbs up.
That Henderson is very good. That Henderson is really good, and that we miss him when he's not there has taken quite a while to get people to actually accept. So I think the idea of going, and that isn't enough, to just go, yeah, we miss him when he's not there, I'm going to have to move him, aren't I?
It's all right, we're going to take a break anyway, don't you worry at all. We're going to go over and we're going to go and hear from John Gibbons and Alan Wares on Brighton and Hove Albion getting supporters in. But it was lovely to have the cameo. It's a friendly, you can do what you want. It's a glorified friendly. We can add small Manchester United supporters from South Wales. Let's get over to John and Alan.
And it is now John Gibbons. And unfortunately, yesterday there was no supporters of either Liverpool or Arsenal at the Community Shield final. There was talk that it was going to be one of these trial games, but it wasn't the case. But where they did have supporters yesterday was at Brighton. And I'm delighted to be joined by Alan Wares from Albion Roar, who's going to tell me what that was like. So first of all, Alan, thanks for joining us on a bank holiday Sunday, I guess you'd call it.
Not at all. You only disturbed me from a Jason Statham film, so okay.
So first of all, are you sort of proud that the Brighton were the first in the Premier League to sort of manage this? Because I know you've been aware of the processes that have been in place. So you guys, where are the first, you know, that I know of? So is that something that pleases you, I guess?
Well, I think if you have to go back to the beginning of lockdown, Brighton were one of the few clubs, certainly the first club, to actually sort of engage with the press and actually have the press conferences, where a lot of clubs actually closed down a lot of their communication lines. So what the club have done during the original close down, and as a result of Project Restart as well, is engaged with the media, engaged with the fans, and kept everyone abreast of what they were doing, you know, not too deep into it, but, you know, what they were doing, you know, what their attitude was. I mean, and we came in for a bit of criticism, not least actually, I have to say this, from certain Liverpool fans who felt that we were actually trying to get the season stopped and therefore Liverpool weren't going to get their trophy. Which was not the case at all. We just wanted to actually have a reasonable and rational debate about how we were going to, you know, get back to it, you know, moving forward, given the government guidelines, given the science that's out there, rather than actually just saying that the whole thing of either not having fans in at all, or if everyone is in a mask, then, you know, I don't care, I can't catch COVID, and all points in between. So everyone has to be circumspect about where we're going with this. And the club, I think the Albion, have certainly been at the forefront of doing that. So in answer to your question, yeah, very proud of what the club is doing, and it's putting it out there. And I think laying the ground for how other clubs could do this. Now, what the club have done yesterday, and it's, you know, there were some fairly strict covenants to it. That doesn't mean to say that every other club has to do that, because every other club has, you know, a different layout, a different stadium in a different location. So how this sort of thing is done is going to vary from club to club. All we've shown is that with an 8% capacity compared to our usual stadium, and even that might be a difference. 8% is 2,500. 8% is different for you guys, and will present a different set of considerations and problems. So all we've shown is a way of doing it, which, you know, going forward, we can now repeat. But whether other clubs can do that is going to be down to them. But I know that every other club is going to be looking at this. And not just every club in England, I think every club across Europe where leagues were closed down, looking at how this can be done.
So, I mean, we'll get into sort of, you know, how you felt it went, you know, from a supporter point of view, I suppose, but from a kind of logistic point of view, were the club pleased with how it went? And from what you saw, was it seemingly, you know, operating, you know, relatively smoothly?
It did seem to go very smoothly. Paul Barber was on record yesterday as saying he was very pleased with the way it went. The club is used to putting on events of 2,500, and that before some wag says, well, that's how many fans we've got. You know, we have corporate events there. We have freshers fairs. You know, we're on the doorstep of two universities down there. We were used to putting on that kind of thing. So, but what's different this time is obviously is that we're putting on an event where people have to socially distance. And I think that the rules that the club, I think because if fans are interested in coming back to the stadium, then we've got to be in connivance. We've got to go along with the rules. And even if they seem draconian, you know, let's see how this sort of thing goes first. So in terms of, you know, the rules, and they were fairly sort of more, there were stricter rules as to our return. They were put out there. They were there, as the club says, on science advice, on government advice. I suppose if the club didn't play ball, then that was going to have ramifications for the rest of the Premier League. So everyone had to sort of play this by the book, play it straight. And in so doing, it requires the cooperation of all fans to go. And if the fans aren't interested in doing that, then you're beaten before you start.
So you obviously there, I know you mentioned to me just before you were in the press box, but in the same stand as where the sort of fans were located. So I guess you got the sort of, you know, little bit of a taste of both, you know, in a way. So how was it? How sort of unusual was it? And how much, you know, it's never going to be exactly the same, but, you know, I'm sure there were still the roars when there's normally roars and the sort of, you know, shouting at the referee when there's normally that.
Oh yeah, I mean there was one. I mean Chelsea scored fairly early on, and there were some people thought it was offside. So when the linesman eventually raised his flag after half an hour, you know, got the biggest cheer of the day. yeah, I mean what you had there, and for those that have visited the American Express Community Stadium, is and it was chosen very specifically. It's not a criticism of Anfield, but or any other club. But there was only three, as I understand it, only three stadiums in the Premier League that could have actually really done this ramp up event, and they were identified as Manchester City, Spurs, and Brighton because of not the size of the grounds per se, but the space and the relative space in the concourses. And for those that have been to Amex, they realize, they know that certainly the home concourses, not so much necessarily the away concourse, but the home concourses are actually quite spacious and are actually a lot bigger pro rata to the size of the stand they serve. So when people are in the concourse having their pies, having their pints, you know, you go in there and you see that the vast majority of people are wearing their masks as per the request. You know, you see the hand sanitizers around, which is unusual, but, you know, that's where we're at. You'll see those various changes. The only time you're not wearing a mask is when you're actually eating your pie and pint. I mean, you know, unless you've got a mask with a hole in it that you've actually sort of specifically done for yourself, then you're going to... But the vast, vast majority of people, you know, adhered to the advice, the guidance. You know, you might see bits and pieces around saying hardly anyone wore masks. That's simply not true. The vast majority did. The compliance was, you know, near absolute. I mean, there are those who, and I think what you've got to remember is there's a reflection across society as a whole, and there's those who believe in the science, and therefore, you know, in some who believe in the science to the extent that they don't even risk going to the game. Okay, fair enough. And then there's those at the far end of the argument who don't believe in COVID at all, and why should I wear a mask and you can't tell me what to do and blah, blah, blah. And in between is the rest of society. And so it's the way that you can actually judge how society is considering it by the level of compliance you've got with this setup, this routine yesterday. And like I say, I think the vast majority of people also realizing that it is the first step, which you don't then want to have to take back. We're realizing, okay, well, let's play with the rules here. Let's play along with the rules here and see what we go here. And I think that for the vast majority of people, it was a little bit weird, but in the great scheme of things, okay.
So there's talk, obviously, everyone will have seen around October time at some point, the idea about 20 to 30% capacity, which is obviously higher than what Brighton had. I've seen some fans saying, oh, I'm not interested. I don't want it. You know, it's going to be no good until everyone's back in there and I don't sort of want to do it. What's your sort of reaction to that based on what you experienced yesterday?
Well, I mean, what we certainly have is 2,500 fans who would be prepared to go. Now, we've got 23,000 season ticket holders, of whom, you know, and the club has already said, well, if we're going to go to 30% capacity in the first instance, we're going to do this by ballot, by a lottery. There are pluses and minuses to any given routine, any given route that you're going to go. And you could say, well, I want this and I want that. And the club held a Zoom conference, and there was over 1,000 people on it, with, you know, explaining what the route they wanted to go with. The head of ticketing services, you know, explaining how she was going to operate it all. Everyone's got obviously their own what ifs. You know, what if I want to do this? I want, you know, I'm with my family. What, you know, can I do this? And so on and so forth. So going forward, we've got this idea that when it comes to 30%, I suspect that the Amex will probably be one of the first places that will be able to cope with it. But also, that's still three and a half times the amount of what we've had today. So I suspect that if we're going to get to 30%, I would have thought another ramp-up event of somewhere in between, say, 15, 18, even 20%, I think needs to be done first. Now, I think that someone like the Amex and probably a few places across the country will be able to cope with that. But we're also told that not every stadium in the Premier League certainly is going to be able to cope with that 30% on account of the fact the size of the concourses, the pinch points in the corners, and so on. So that the social distancing, if it's going to be observed, 30% at the moment, I think for a lot of clubs, not all of them, but some of them, is going to be ambitious. And therefore, you then set an argument of, do you have 30% or do you have a fixed number of, say, 8,000, of 10,000? Now, 10,000 in Anfield is going to be a lot more spacious than 10,000 at the Amex. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are the things that I think that everyone will be chewing over in the next few days on the back of what's happened today. Right now, I think 30% is ambitious, but achievable.
So, I mean, very last question, Alan. Did you enjoy it? Did you have a nice day?
It was a good day, actually. It was a decent match. There was plenty of, you know, there was atmosphere there. I mean, for 2,500 people making a noise in one stand, it actually worked quite well. I mean, also shows that should the day come, and this is an interesting point from the Premier League that they've got to consider, is that we have now proved that we can actually host 8%. We can host 2,500. So if the Premier League are going to say, no, they're all behind closed doors, we can actually prove and say, well, actually, we can host 2,500. And along those lines, we'd probably say we could host 5,000. And we're going to be champing at the bit now. So we've actually almost sort of created a rod for our own back here by proving that we can do it and then not being allowed to do it. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen going forward. But as for the day itself, it was a good workout. We saw our players, you know, it was effectively for both Brighton and Chelsea, put out two different teams in each half. You know, it was a fairly evenly matched game. Chelsea bossed the possession, but, you know, didn't do a great deal with it. You know, we can see a lot of the new players and the loanees and that are returning, coming back and adjusting to Graham Potter's style. So, yeah, I mean, it was a day I certainly enjoyed. And actually, like you say, was kind of pleased to be part of something of which the club is leading the way on.
Certainly is, and hopefully it benefits all of us who would like to get back into the stadium. Huge thanks to Alan, as I say again, for joining me on a Sunday, and back to the main show.
Great stuff from Alan. We'll obviously be talking to Alan on and off through the season and the number of different sort of preview shows that we do. Also, going into the new season, and we'll be making it clear what we'll be up to as we get closer and closer to the start of the campaign. But we are, Gareth, changing the way in which we're going to do video around matches, both before games and after games. We're really excited about it. There's a raft of new shows for people.
Yeah, we are really excited. You know, the situation has obviously changed a few things in how we've had to do stuff over the last few months. And we, you know, we've got through that and we've introduced some new things. We've got some new ideas for the new season and really looking forward to getting stuck into them. We just thought that, you know, if you subscribe to both podcast and video, that maybe there was a little bit too much crossover, because we know some people consume absolutely everything that we do, which is absolutely fine, which is great, to be honest with you. So what we thought is we'd shake it up a little bit and introduce some new formats. So we're going to be doing that very, very soon. As ever, we welcome your feedback, good and bad, honest, and all the rest of it, in all the ways that you do give us feedback. So we do read it all on Twitter, Facebook, even on Raw, everywhere, basically, that you say something about the Anfield app. We're taking it on board and we're talking about it internally and we're trying to get better and better all the time.
Excellent, yeah, and you'll be pleased to know that one of those shows involves me and mostly Robbo going for a pint on a Friday afternoon. Up the Reds, a true innovation around that sort of stuff. So we've got loads and loads of little bits and pieces for you. We'll detail them out. If you don't read my email every single day, well, it's not every single day, it tends to be about 4 a week, I'll be putting it in there, putting it on all the obvious places, what we're going to do, and we'll do a little mini video that'll explain everything that'll be coming around the matches as well. But it is thought of both before and after the games, everything we're looking to do. And there'll be more bits and pieces. You may well have noticed that we did review on Sunday. More bits and pieces when Liverpool play on Saturday is done on Sundays as well for you. Just trying to get closer and closer to the final whistle. And as the games come so thick and fast, we are very conscious that if you talk about a game that took place at 12:30 on Saturday and you talk about it at 4 p.m. on Monday, there's every chance Liverpool will be playing 7:30 on Tuesday. So we're going to look to get a little speedier on that as well for everybody. So across the board, some changes coming. It's theanfieldapp.com/subscribe to subscribe. So yes, I also very much again, thank you very much to Alan for taking the time and letting us know about Brighton getting supporters in.
So I've been getting those emails from you for months now, and every single day I still go, oh, Neil's emailed me. every single day. Oh, thought I was special.
I wonder what Neil wants. Oh no. It's not an invitation to a nice soiree. It's instead some sort of very, very formulaic writing. Ian, the transfers. It feels as though this is one of those things that's heating up in discourse rather than heating up in reality. Liverpool haven't got to finish the business until the 5th of October. And then obviously that will reopen very, very quickly from the 1st of January. But it looks, you know, increasingly like it is a policy decision from Liverpool as to how strict they're going to be around costs this summer. And that is difficult for some people to take in the context of Liverpool having got to a Champions League final, won a Champions League, and then won a league title, that Liverpool are still very, very fiscally responsible.
Yeah, and I think, you know, whenever you have a conversation about the ownership and the spend, you're never going to please everyone. But I think that's absolutely fine. So I think, you know, when I come on these shows, I always think, well, regardless of whether people want to hear it or not, I have to say how I feel about it. And I think I understand the caution from a point of view of there's a pandemic. We all know what we've lived through the last kind of 4 or 5 months, and it will continue to go on. But I think where the owners might have a problem is if all the clubs suddenly do continue spending, and all of a sudden Liverpool Football Club, who've won the Premier League, the European Cup, as you've mentioned, have obviously reaped in a lot of commercial money as well. If they don't, say, outspend the Leeds United, then it becomes a little bit difficult to square that circle. And I know that the owners are putting in whatever the club generates, you know, they're putting it back into the club. But I think James Pearce put a tweet out yesterday along those lines, and I think that's absolutely fine. But I think I've listened to Kev Walsh on one of these shows recently, and he talked about seeing this as an opportunity, and I kind of knew where he was coming from, because I think there's only so much this manager can do, despite being a genius, and he is an absolute genius. But I've said it myself on other shows on Gutters, where you can only keep asking these players to go again so many times, and to ask them to go again for the third time feels huge, to be honest. And we've seen it with other teams. There's not many teams across the history of football without any investment over 2-3 years can retain that successfulness, because it just tapers off. Players need other quality around them to push them. We know that. You see it right throughout football. You know, Man City recently, that third year, asked them to go again. They can't go again. They need that extra little bit of quality adding to the squad. And I think that's what a lot of us are asking for. We know it's difficult. It's not easy. But I think there is a thing about maybe FSG being a little less cautious, in my opinion. And I've said it before, I think, you know, Jurgen Klopp, this only works with Jurgen Klopp. I don't think this model works with any other manager in world football, the current model that we've got operating, where we've not really spent a penny in any of the last few transfer windows. And if Jurgen was on the call, he may say, well, listen, those other transfer windows, I was fine with it because I was happy with the squad. And that might be true. But I always think managers will never refuse a little bit of quality if you'd offer it to them. But one or two things have changed recently in Jürgen's language, and you pick up a little bit of it pre-Charity Shield, and he talks a little bit like, can you go on forever, not adding players? Now, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's along those lines. And that's when it starts to worry me. Broadly speaking, I'm always okay with it if the manager's okay with it. But if there's a sniff of the manager not being happy with it and suddenly he's not getting his players, and we know you want a Timo Werner, listen, it didn't happen, big wages, yeah, get all that. I think you can still make a strong case for making that deal happen, by the way, but it doesn't happen. And if they suddenly don't get Thiago, and we know he wants Thiago, he's spoken about Thiago, he does the thing where he very rarely does, he speaks about a player, he's done it before, so we know he likes him. There's enough narrative flying around that tells us Liverpool want this player, but can they make it happen? And I think it's hard to look at Liverpool, all the success they've had. Yes, there's been a pandemic, I get all that, but it's still hard to look at it and think Liverpool can't make that deal for Thiago happen, even in the current climate. It feels difficult to square it.
Well, I'll just push back to you on one aspect of this, Ian, where we want to say the manager's working miracles, and the manager has worked, you know, has been absolutely brilliant, and he's done magnificently well. But for me, I've spent years saying football's a question of wage bills, and Liverpool's wage bill is comparable with Manchester United's and Manchester City's at the end of the 18-19 season, and it's higher than Chelsea's. Now, people will try to say that you can't trust the figures that you get from Manchester City and all that sort of stuff, and there is a slight element where they've got those other clubs. But teams like Manchester United and Juventus are listed on stock exchanges. The reason why we know so much about Juventus' transfer dealings is they have to put it out every single penny, and that's why it's always quite insightful what Juventus have done. There's a thing about English football where if you look at so Barcelona pay the most wages out by a million miles, and one of the reasons for that is Messi. Then there's a gap. Then there's loads of sides between second and ninth going to the end of the 2019 season. And then there's another massive gap to Arsenal in 10th. And Liverpool, Man United, Man City and Chelsea are all in that pack between second and ninth. So are Juventus, so are Barcelona, so are Real Madrid, so are PSG and so are Bayern Munich. So that's that little mini pack there. Barcelona there, Arsenal down in 10th, and as I say, a big, big gap. But my point is, the manager is actually, broadly speaking, getting out what Liverpool are putting in. He's doing better than that because Liverpool are getting 90-odd points, et cetera, et cetera. But my thing is that that'll be where Liverpool will say, no, this is how we are set up for sustainability because we pay the market value for these brilliant footballers. We've got the brilliant footballers. We've helped make the brilliant footballers brilliant. That's what the manager's done ever so well. But we're in that pack with United, with City, with Chelsea, which we haven't been. We haven't been for 5, 10, 15 years minimum.
No, and I think that's fair comments. And I think, you know, if we're sitting here now and you say, as the host, you say to us, Ian, Amelia, Robbo, write pros and cons down about the ownership, we could all put together a fairly strong list of both sides. And I think that's perfectly fine to say that. They've done some good things. They've done some things where they've upset me, but they've put those things right. But I would say, well, don't get them wrong in the first place.
Some serious bollocks, yeah.
Don't get them wrong in the first place because some of them are really open goals. But that said, you correct them, so fair play. And I get the wage bill thing, and it obviously is a thing, and I think, you know, Liverpool have, but that's come with success. So when you start winning stuff, you've got to start paying the players more. So some of that comes with success, and some of that you'll pick up through the commercial stuff because all of a sudden Nike want to be your partner. So, and I know that deal might not look quite as glamorous as it did before the pandemic. So I get all that. And I don't think I'm sitting here saying I want Liverpool to compete with Man City, go toe to toe, because that's not feasible. And you could even argue the same with Chelsea and United. But I think the policy of, and it feels like you've almost got to shift one out to get one in, that feels almost too cautious. So Tsimikas comes in, but he comes in when Lovren goes.
Yeah.
And you get the impression that Liverpool have got to figure out what they're doing with Origi, what they're doing with Shaqiri, what they're doing with others before they can make moves. And my concern is, you can dally and you can dither for so long. Sometimes you've got to put your fucking balls on the table and maybe do it a little bit earlier and take the risk because it means you get the footballer in. Now, if I'm sitting here and Liverpool miss out to Thiago and all of a sudden Arsenal come in or United come in and swoop that player up, I'll find that hard to swallow, I have to say. I'll find that a bitter pill, and I think the manager would as well. And I think that's when you start to maybe feel a little bit concerned. And it hasn't happened yet. So, listen, you've got a caveat here. And Liverpool could end up going and doing some great business. So if we're sitting here in 2 or 3 months' time and Liverpool have nailed Thiago, and maybe they've gone and got Sarr as well, and maybe they've found a solution to the centre-half problem, or maybe they're just going to play Fabinho there, I can sit here and go, you know what, that's a decent summer, and we can all go away, get on with our lives and be happy with it. But if that doesn't happen and all of a sudden they just have what they currently have, I think that's a huge gamble. And it's almost a bigger gamble than not going into the transfer market, because obviously for FSG to increase the club's value, you've got to keep being successful. So I think it's going to be really hard to ask the same group of players, as good as they've been, as brilliant as they are, to ask them to go again without a little bit of quality added is really hard. Listen, the good lads at the club, they'll want this to happen because they want to be pushed in training. They need to be pushed in training. And at the minute, I think there's just a couple of areas where Liverpool need that to be going on, and it might not happen. And that for me, that would frustrate me.
There's a really good thread this morning, Gareth, Swiss Ramble, on Chelsea's finances with relation to FFP, but also relation to real world. And those two things are different. And he gets into a lot of detail on the account, Swiss Ramble. And at times, you know, you've got to think a little bit as you're going through it. But what's interesting is, as it sort of works right the way through, there's the real world money. Someone has to pay the bill. And he mentions Bank of Rome the idea of them having cash flow, Chelsea, and they can always call on Abramovich and they'll see it as money well spent. He goes on to say, and as I say, I couldn't be given a more citing him more. Swiss Ramble as he goes through, if it cements the spot in the top four, and etc. etc. And then he also says, and Chelsea could also improve their finances by selling some fringe players, on such as Batshuayi, Bakayoko, Barkley, Emerson, Zappa Costa, and Drinkwater. The window closes on the 5th. And my point here is that yes, there's FFP stuff, yes, there's Abramovich's own money, yes, there's a cash flow question, but what actually Chelsea are doing is they're not being cautious. They're thinking, we'll get a lot of this money back on lads we sell. We'll do the expenditure up front and now we'll just sort out these sales in one way or another. And they've got a couple of years to do it because they're running one FFP year into two. So they'll get it all sorted out and they can have the attitude of, and if not, in the meantime, we've got an owner who can make up the shortfall as and when we need it. And that money will eventually come in. We can take that gamble. And that's what I think that Chelsea have done. And I think it's all perfectly logical. And they've been running this unbelievably complex loan player diddle for 5, 6, 7 years where they've got 40 odd players out on loan, so you know eventually they'll get a fee for someone. With Liverpool, there's obviously a different set of circumstances, but to what extent is this also a conversation about being cautious or not being cautious? So for instance, thinking, well, let's just get the lads in who we want to get in, you know, who the manager wants to get in, whether that's Werner, whether or not that's Thiago, and we'll worry about sorting the business side out later. We'll find a way around it. Eventually it'll come round to our general sense of direction or a Liverpool. And Liverpool, it looks to me like a going, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to take those gambles. We don't feel as though we need to take those gambles. Is that what you do? You think it's almost a policy decision as much as it's anything else?
Yeah, I think so. And look, you know, you've got to think about the manager and what a position he's in now. So, you know, he's widely regarded, and rightly so, as one of, if not the best manager in the world. And, you know, you watched that documentary last night and, you know, you're like, I'm so grateful that we've got this fella. I'm so grateful that, you know, when it goes through the managers and all the problems that you've had in the past, you know, you get to the end of the documentary and just think, it's so brilliant that we finally won that league. It's just another reminder of everything that we went through. And this is the man that did it. So he's got that power and he knows he's got that power. And at any point, he could, if there was some kind of, you know, situation going on behind the scenes where he's being denied what he really wants and all this, you know, he could hint at it. He could say something, and he knows that the fan base would be right behind him and would be up in arms. And he's never ever done it. In fact, he's done quite the opposite. You know, he's come out and said other clubs are running different ways, and good for them. That's not the way we run it. And he personally has been quite conservative over transfers. Then you've got FSG who are quite conservative at times over transfers. And so, you know, I kind of think that they're probably on the same page over a lot of this, genuinely. Like, you know, there's a point as well where he's the leader and he doesn't want to be seen to rock the boat. And maybe he does moan behind the scenes and then says something different in public. We can't know that, though. We can only speculate at it. But, you know, I get it. Look, I totally get it. You know, I'd love us to sign Thiago. I'd love us to sign another top-class centre-half. I'd love us to get someone brilliant who's a backup to the front three. But who are all of those people? And who are all of those people within our budget as well? So, you know, you mentioned the wage bill, 320 million or thereabouts. You know, you've got 50 million quid going on the new training facility. We've obviously seen what they've done at Anfield. I find it tiresome that there's a constant sort of line around, almost like there's a conspiracy, almost like there's something going on, like, you know, that FSG are these bastards, and you know what I mean? And it's just that boring for me. We've won the league, enjoy winning the league. And look, if they are conservative and if they decide, you know, there's six or seven players that we expected to shift out this summer and we expected to get in the region of, what, 70, 80 million in, and we haven't, and we might not get that because no one might want to sign Shaqiri, Origi, Wilson, Gruitch, Karius, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so therefore we haven't got, and like, I don't get the fume either when people say things like, why are we a sell to buy club? Because that, isn't that how you run a business? Like, aren't you meant to balance the books? Like, it just seems to me a lot of people are pushing for an oligarch or for someone to come in with questionable human rights records and throw a load of money at it. I'm all right with how the club's run. And I think, you know, the BBC documentary, as I say, was a reminder of some of the real tough times we've been through, of some of the times when it was a bit shit being a Liverpool fan. And this isn't one of those times. Like, I wanted us to sign Werner, and I was gutted we didn't. And we'll see how he gets on at Chelsea. But I do think we'll be all right. You know, I'd love us to buy these players. If we do, we do. If we don't, we don't. I'll still be a Liverpool fan. I'll still be looking forward to the day I can go and stand on the Kop again. I'll still support Liverpool. And I'm all right. I'm all right when we've got Jurgen Klopp there, because he's permanently putting his arms around the whole club and making it feel all right. And it feels all right.
Well, the question, Amelia, for me is feelings. And that's why I think it's interesting to what it feels like. Because at the minute, it feels like I can't believe the amount of anxiety that there is around the people and how they're supporting the club. But I can't argue with what it feels like, if you know what I mean. You can do the rational stuff till the cows come home, but it's what it feels like. And then the flip side of that is that you've got someone like Gareth there who feels firstly all right about the club, but doesn't feel all right about everything that's going on around it. And it's driving him to a form of exasperation because he can't understand why other people are living in their feelings as much as they are around Liverpool Football Club and are endlessly venting around Liverpool Football Club at precisely this moment. And all of this, I can mention the Swiss Ramble and I can mention the way in which the money works and James Pearce can say what James Pearce says. And everyone can try to state the facts, but everybody is living in their feelings and not in their facts.
Yeah, as are Robbo and I in thinking that we're being entirely rational and going, do you know what, it's exactly a business. And also, ultimately, it sounds that's our approach to it in our field. And I think at times like this, but especially given the wider context of things that are going on, I think Robbo's right that a lot of people like to feel like there's a bigger picture going on that we're all not seeing, whereas quite simply, it is a business and these are decisions that have to be made. And a lot of people might not like that for something that has so many feelings attached to it, something that has so much emotion invested in it and that means so much more than just any other business. But the reality of it is that it's a business and that decisions have to be made, and that with something like, obviously very controversially and with great difficulty, the furlough decision, which is made and then reversed, if you want a club to make decisions like that that you think are perfectly aligned with our principles, our morals, what we stand for as a club, that is a business decision that then has business consequences in terms of how things have to be handled and kind of like decisions that have to be made after that. And it is difficult because, as you say, you can make all of the, what you think are the rational cases. You can talk about all of the kind of very serious considerations that have to be taken into account. But then when you hear everyone else flapping, it's hard not to then either flap in the same way or to do the kind of other world flap where you're going, why is everyone flapping? And we all get very, very worked up by this. But I don't know. It's tricky because I think it's a really boring and unpopular thing to say. Football clubs are businesses, and this is a business that needs to be run in a way that is viable and sustainable. And while I completely appreciate what Ian says, that kind of if anyone's able to take a risk or kind of, you know, make that leap and then hope it'll sort itself out, surely it's us, surely we're in the position to do that. But then I don't know, I think I land quite firmly in the Robbo camp of going, I'm not particularly worried about anything, to be honest. If anyone can go again and do it again, it's our team. We see teams that spend a lot more than us or that kind of do it in a less responsible way, and we still win the league. So,
Neil, just another quick one on this. I, you know, when I say what I've just said there, I think it's okay to challenge and to scrutinise. It doesn't necessarily mean you want the owners out. That's not what I'm saying at all. And I think Robbo alluded to it there on the BBC doc last night. You know, you do get a glimpse of the past on that, and it's scary. It really reminds you of what it was like back then. But I think sometimes you're right to frame it in the sense of feelings, because I think sometimes, you know, you look at it and you think, this football club right now is the most attractive it's been for such a long time. And there's maybe a little sense of not making hay while the sun shines. And I'm not saying any of this is easy, because it's really hard because of what's going on in the world. And I think most sensible people get that. But I just think sometimes there's maybe almost just a little bit too much caution when there's calculated gambles that I think could pay off, but I'm not in their position. So it's easy for me to say, I get that. And I think that's where maybe the frustration is, where you see there's these players who really want to come to the club, and we know the manager wants them, and we can't quite connect the dots for whatever reason. And that's where maybe a little bit of frustration kicks in. That doesn't mean to say that, you know, you should have all these people saying, get them out of the club and all that. That's nonsense for me, because, you know, broadly speaking, they've been really good owners. But I think this is a time now where I'm just hoping they maybe release the shackles a little bit. Difficult to know because of the things I've mentioned. But whilst Liverpool are in this position, with this group of players, with this manager that they've got, and he will not be here forever, by the way, and it becomes so much more difficult to do this when he leaves the club, this is the time now to really crank up and maybe rack up a couple of more trophies, because others around us aren't going to stand still. They're already looking at how they're going to challenge Liverpool going forward. They're putting money on the table. We know they've got more than us. But that's maybe where the frustration is a little bit for me, where I see these players, they're desperate to come, and we can't quite make it happen at the minute, but it could change.
Thank you very much indeed, Gareth Roberts, Amelia Bonner and Ian Ryan. I hope you enjoyed that this week. Obviously, we ended out towards the end of the week talking Reds out a couple of times across the course of the week on video. Everything that you need from the Anfield Wrap as we all gear up Liverpool Leeds United 12th of September. Let's focus in on that and take it deadly, deadly seriously.
Sports Social Podcast Network.